From Vermont to Arkansas, Washington to Indiana, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, if Congress fails to extend the Trump 2017 tax cuts, how much will that cost you? The National Taxpayers Union Foundation has a new report, and Matthias Gugel is here with the answer. The U.S. House of Representatives has made considerable progress toward crafting the reconciliation bill that will preserve the Trump tax cuts. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. There has been a lot of debate over the use of tariffs. Are they helping or hurting the U.S. economy? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine enters the discussion. And Medicaid has expanded well beyond its original intent, and the cost is becoming unsustainable. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Trump 2017 tax cuts are set to expire at the end of the year, and Congress is working on an extension. The National Taxpayers Union Foundation has issued a new report that details how much additional taxpayers in each state will pay if the cuts are not extended. Matthias Gugel is Director of State External Affairs at NTU. He joins us now with details. Matthias, welcome to American Radio Journal. Matthias, you have put together this report, which is a state-by-state analysis of what's going to happen if these 2017 tax cuts expire. Give us the general overview. What's the impact going to be on the American taxpayer and particularly on American families?
On American families, this means less money in their budget. Nothing is going to happen, and they're automatically going to see thousands of dollars that they have to pay more in taxes next year. That means more money that they won't have for groceries, more money that they won't have for rising utility costs. It means that basic things like vacations or trying to fund their kids' school supplies is going to be even harder to do next year if Congress doesn't act by the end of the year and re-up these Trump tax cuts.
Families will be losing some very important deductions as well, correct?
Yeah, for example, the child tax credit. When you're looking at families that are trying to raise kids, that are trying to pay for groceries for hungry teenagers, that are trying to pay for school, that are trying to pay for daycare, the rising costs of daycare are astronomical. When families are hurting that much and they're already being faced with rising costs in every sector of the economy, and now we're looking at potentially just automatically, because Congress might not do anything, they're going to get less of their own money because they're going to pay more in taxes to the tune of thousands for states. Like states like Pennsylvania, for example, $2,500 a year is going to be lost to every tax filer.
In addition to the impact on all of us as we do our budget at the kitchen table here, there's also going to be an impact on business as well, because businesses got a fair tax break from this bill as well.
Yeah. When you look at business expensing, that's a huge part of what is going on here. And so businesses in Pennsylvania right now can only write off 60% of what they spend on new equipment. So if that's a delivery van, if that's a bakery oven, or maybe even a new roof for the shop, next year that number drops even more. So at the same time, the state's going to limit how much interest they can deduct if they took out a loan to make those investments. So really what's happening here is they're getting squeezed from both sides. They can't fully deduct on their taxes what they buy. They can't fully deduct what it costs to borrow. And that's just not bad tax policy. That's a real hit on small businesses. They're trying to grow and hire and are trying to expand and do the right thing for their community.
It's interesting here, Matthias. You've talked about the impact on families, the impact on small business. But if you listen to the messaging from the left, they frame this as a big tax cut for the rich. So it's not really just a sop to higher-end taxpayers. It hits everybody, doesn't it?
Oh, 100%. 80% of Americans are going to see their taxes increase next year if we do nothing. 80%? That's not just the rich. I don't know. I don't think the people that I see as my neighbors and all that consider themselves as rich, and yet they certainly make up that 80% of American taxpayers that are going to get hit. And beyond that, Democrats would be foolish to just ignore this, too. We did some new polling at NTU that shows even 51% of Democrats are like, yeah, it's not, now is not the time for a tax increase on us.
As we take a look then at the trickle-down effect on this, federal tax policy has an impact on a number of state tax policies as well. So what impact is this going to have on state taxes?
Yeah, so certainly what we're going to see is because people are going to have less money, we're actually going to see potentially a shrink in our GDP, in our economic output. So that means that you're going to be collecting less taxes in your state governments as well. So you're going to have less revenues because people just aren't doing as much. There won't be the economic activity. People won't be doing vacations as much because those are going to be something that are the first things cut. That's what I would cut first, probably, if I were facing this kind of a drastic tax increase. So when the economy produces less, when businesses aren't working as hard, when they have less money to spend, that means that state governments are also going to feel a crunch, too, and it means those local services they provide are going to be even more difficult. So state lawmakers need to watch out for this in a big, big way.
You, as I mentioned at the outset, have done a state-by-state analysis of the impact. So talk for a minute or two, if you will, here, Matthias, about which states are going to be the most dramatically impacted if this Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is not renewed.
So something I want to point out is we've got a list of 10 states, and they range from Colorado to Connecticut to New Jersey, New Mexico, Oregon. There's not really a geographic trend that we see there, and there's not necessarily even a red state, blue state trend that we see there. We're seeing states across the spectrum in a whole bunch of different ways that are really going to get hit. In a state like Colorado, for example, you're going to see an increase of almost $3,800 per filer. That's $4,000 next year that the average filer is going to lose out on because of Congress just not getting their act together, not listening to their constituents, and not passing this by the end of the year.
Speaking of Congress getting their act together, what is the process by which this would be renewed? Is this part of this one big beautiful bill that the president keeps talking about?
Yeah, it certainly could be. We would love to see whatever path it needs to take to get passed at the end of the day. Congress is a very fascinating thing, and they aren't inclined to do anything. So the biggest part of the process that I'd like your listeners to pay attention to is talk to your senators, talk to your representatives, talk to your state senators and state representatives, too. Let them know where you are economically, and let them know that you are keeping an eye on what's happening by the end of this year, so that hopefully we won't have this automatic multi-$1,000 tax increase on middle-class Americans.
Not only a tax increase on middle-class Americans here, Matthias, but the impact of such a dramatic amount of money, such a significant amount of money being sucked out of the private sector, put back into government, that's bound to have an impact on the overall economy, wouldn't it?
Oh, definitely. This is going to be a huge, huge tax decrease. It means less money in every American's pocket. When you have less, when your neighbors have less, when that's not happening just in your city, but your state, that has a compound effect. And that means that really we're going to see a really tough time in the economy for Americans all across the country, regardless of state.
We have been talking with Matthias Gugel, who is Director of State External Affairs for the National Taxpayer Union Foundation. He's written a state-by-state analysis of what will happen if the 2017 tax cuts are allowed to expire at the end of the year. Matthias, tell us a little bit about NTU, the National Taxpayers Union Foundation. Also, I'm sure folks might be interested in reading your report. Where can they find it?
To begin with, you can find our report at ntu.org/state. That's ntu.org/states. And you can find in that report exactly what the impact is going to be to your state, no matter where you are in the country. NTU, the National Taxpayers Union, which I work for, we are fighting for taxpayers across the nation. We've got a wonderful federal team that is working on trying to make sure that these tax cuts get re-upped. I'm actually part of our state team. I'm on our state affairs team. And so I'm in state capitals from Harrisburg to Madison, Wisconsin, to Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And we're in those state capitals trying to make sure that your tax dollars are spent wisely, to make sure that you're not getting tax increases. And we're doing our best to fight for you in those state capitals.
Matthias Gugel of the National Taxpayers Union Foundation. Matthias, thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thanks so much, Loman.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, keeping an eye on this reconciliation bill. I know we've been talking about it for months now. However, it is the single most important piece of legislation that we are going to see this year. So we're going to see where it stands in the process with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, good to have you here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, Scott, as I mentioned, this is a very important bill. It's something that the president wants very much to see get done, and not quite sure when it's going to get over the finish line, but fill us in. There's been some progress in the House in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, the big news is that recently, eight of the House committees that were instructed to have either deficit reduction targets or small spending increases completed their work. And this next week, we are expecting the Energy and Commerce Committee to mark up their portion of the One Big Beautiful Bill. And once that's completed, you'll see the House Ways and Means Committee move quickly, because what the Energy and Commerce Committee needs to determine is whether or not there are going to be major reforms or minimal reforms to the Medicaid program to sort of hit their deficit reduction targets. And, you know, people hear deficit reduction and Medicaid. These are not what we would consider cuts to benefits, cuts to people that really need the Medicaid program. If you recall, way back in 2009, House Democrats led by Nancy Pelosi talked about increasing coverage in health insurance and health care. And the idea was, through Obamacare, to try to open up these federal exchanges where people could purchase health insurance through Obamacare and really get coverage. But the reality is that coverage did not notably increase through the Obamacare exchanges. Instead, the secondary portion of Obamacare included the option for states to expand their Medicaid population and for those costs to be largely borne on the federal government. And so you have basically what's a federal match, and that's a percentage of how much the federal government is going to pay for Medicaid in the states compared to the state. And there's this 90-10 ratio for the expansion population, where really some states are obviously having to take on more costs when it comes to dollars, but not when it comes to the percentage, because of the number of people that are pushed into the Medicaid expansion population. And these aren't the vulnerable. These aren't, you know, single mothers with children. We are talking about what are known as able-bodied individuals. So I think that the Energy and Commerce Committee next week is really going to have to resolve what sort of bold reforms they are interested in taking on in order to provide for some deficit reduction. So this is a big, big question. I know that there's a lot of moderates out there, and they are incredibly nervous about reforming Medicaid because they care more about their reelection than they do about the future of the Medicaid program and protecting that vulnerable population.
As this works its way through the House, give us a roadmap here, Scott, of what's going to happen next. Where does it go to from here, and what does it take to get it over the finish line?
Yeah, well, the finish line is obviously getting closer and closer day by day. I'm confident in the ability of our Republican majorities in the House and Senate to complete One Big Beautiful Bill. I want to be crystal clear with that. So next week, we are expecting that Energy and Commerce House Committee to mark up their bill. Then you'll have the House Ways and Means Committee. Then everything gets tied together by the House Budget Committee, and it should hit the floor the week of May 19th.
What are they looking at, Scott, as sort of the final deadline? When do they expect to actually get this one big, beautiful bill to the president's desk?
Well, once the House passes it, and let's say that they do pass it by May 23rd, it'll go over to the United States Senate, and the Senate is the legislative body where reconciliation actually matters, because there's a thing known as privilege and the way that each provision gets adjudicated via various points of order, because they need to deal with revenues, spending, or the debt limit, And if it's more policy in nature, that referee in the Senate, the parliamentarian, can rule provisions out of order and they could fall out of the bill altogether. If the bill changes at all, and I promise you that it will, it'll pass the Senate, and then it would have to go back to the House of Representatives for final passage. It's a convoluted, complicated process, but we're excited for the opportunity ahead to ultimately reduce spending, reduce the deficit, and cut taxes in a big, big way.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Club for Growth is an organization that's united in the idea of economic opportunity and liberty and free enterprise. And tax policy is a big part of that. If you want to learn more about the club, you can check us out at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll continue keeping an eye on this process next week. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
President Trump is using tariffs to impact the flow of international trade, but are they helping or hurting? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine weighs in.
Since returning to office back in January, President Donald Trump has offered lots of different reasons for hiking tariffs on American imports. He's said that tariffs are going to make the country rich and strong. He's said that they will boost tax revenue, that they will reduce the trade deficit, that they will create leverage for other trade negotiations. Now, a lot of those arguments are somewhat problematic or even counterproductive and contradictory. We're not going to get into all of that today. Today, what I want to talk about is the president's latest argument, which I think might be the most foolish, maybe the most socialist one that he's rolled out yet. And regardless of what you think about his tariff strategy as a political agenda, I think we should all be able to agree that this understanding of the way tariffs are supposed to work is seriously flawed. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. That argument, one that the president has now used several times in the past few weeks, is that America is something like a giant department store, and Trump is the general manager or the shopkeeper. For example, here's what the president said earlier this week while meeting with Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney.
My people haven't made it clear. We will sign some deals. But much bigger than that is we're going to put down the price that people are going to have to pay to shop in the United States. Think of us as a super luxury store, a store that has the goods. You're going to come and you're going to pay a price, and we're going to give you a very good price. We're going to make very good deals, and in some cases, we'll adjust.
Now, as I said, this is actually the second or third time that Trump has rolled out this same analogy in the past couple of weeks, including in that big interview with Time magazine about a week ago. And so it doesn't seem like this is just a random idea that popped into his head during that media appearance with the Canadian Prime Minister, but rather some sort of an intentional messaging strategy. And I think it's worth taking a minute to appreciate just honestly how wrong this understanding of the country is, and wrong on a few different levels. The most obvious objection, of course, is that the country is not a department store. Thinking of America in those terms is collectivist, even socialist. If a Democratic president spoke like this, I think Republicans and conservatives and libertarians, everybody in the center, everybody capable of thinking coherently about economics would stand up and say, wait a minute, no, of course that's not true. The president is not the CEO of America. American workers are not his employees. The president doesn't get to decide a fair price for transactions that are ultimately between individuals, because that's what all trade is, between two people or two businesses. It's not the United States trading with Canada. It's businesses in the United States or people in the United States trading with people and businesses in Canada and other parts of the world. So factually and philosophically, this analogy is just fundamentally wrong. But okay. Let's set that aside for a minute and pretend that Trump is right. Just let's go down this road. Let's pretend that America is a big store that has all the goods and that the president is the shopkeeper and he's going to run things. And then let's ask how a department store that followed this strategy would actually operate, because I think this is instructive and it gets at one of the fundamental things that Trump fails to understand about the way tariffs work. So I guess the first thing that would happen is that store would tell its suppliers, the people that it buys inventory from, to just go take a hike. because the store is currently well stocked and the shopkeeper doesn't want to spend any more money bringing in new inventory. He thinks he's going to save money by not buying more stuff. I mean, that's effectively what Trump told Carney during their meeting on Tuesday. He said at one point, we really don't want Canadian steel and we don't want Canadian aluminum and various other things. Now, Trump may not want those things, but the problem is that lots of American companies do. Lots of American companies buy Canadian aluminum and steel and other imported goods all the time. In fact, more than half of the imports to the United States are raw materials, intermediate parts, or equipment. In other words, it's the stuff that businesses here, manufacturing firms here, need to make more stuff, to make other things, to make their own finished goods. And many of those imports, of course, do come from Canada, which is one of America's biggest trading partners. Many of those imports come from other parts of the world, too. So now go back to the department store analogy, even though, yes, it's flawed. In this case, what would be happening is that the shopkeeper is saying he's saving money by refusing to buy products from his suppliers. And then next, the shopkeeper would decide to raise prices on everything. That's what the tariffs are in this analogy. So in the shopkeeper's way of thinking about this, the higher prices from the tariffs means the store will be making more money from all of its customers because it'll be charging them more. And it won't be spending anything on inventory. So great, we're making more money and we're not spending anything. Mission accomplished. But of course, the problem with that approach should be pretty evident. A lot of customers would end up buying fewer things because of the higher prices. The store would be less competitive against its competitors. And then even so, even with fewer customers, the existing inventory will eventually be depleted. So instead of making more money, the store now has higher prices, fewer customers, empty shelves, and I don't know, the employees are probably starting to look at each other, wondering who's going to get fired first. And then you've got the problem with the suppliers. After, you know, getting them all upset, the shopkeeper might now have a hard time getting them to sell anything to the store in the future, once he backtracks and realizes the mess he's made. So in the end, nearly everyone ends up worse off. The suppliers make fewer sales, the customers pay higher prices, the employees might lose their jobs, and the store ultimately goes out of business. Now, again, I think this is a flawed metaphor for understanding how America works. America is not a department store. But if it were, this wouldn't be the way to run one. And I think there's something instructive there. Now, again, you can think tariffs are a good idea or a bad idea. You could think tariffs used in certain ways are a good idea and used in other ways are a bad idea. There's lots of nuance in this debate, and that's fine. But this basic analogy, I think, gets at something that Trump fundamentally misunderstands about how businesses work and about how countries work and about how trade works. And I think that misunderstanding is quite instructive when it comes to some of the problems that his tariff policy is now facing. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of this and other things going on around the country this week at Reason.com. And of course, join me again next week right here on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Medicaid is a prime example of a program that started with good intentions and has grown to unsustainable levels. We learn more from Jonathan Williams of the American Legislative Exchange Council on this American Radio Journal commentary.
As usual in Washington, the road to fiscal ruin is paved with good intentions and taxpayer dollars. And nowhere is this more apparent than in Medicaid, one of the largest and most mismanaged welfare programs in the country. Originally created in the 1960s as part of President Lyndon Johnson's Great Society programs, Medicaid was intended to provide social safety net health care to the truly needy, low-income families with children and individuals with disabilities. That was the purpose. And a very reasonable one, if limited in scope. But like most government programs, it didn't stay limited. Over time, the program expanded far beyond its original design. Today, it serves more than 70 million Americans, including a growing number of healthy working-age adults with no children, who were never intended recipients. This shift didn't happen by accident. It was a result of deliberate federal policy choices. Most recently, the improperly named Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare. One of its key provisions was the so-called Medicaid expansion, which opened up the program to non-disabled adults without dependents, so long as their income fell below a certain threshold. To get the states on board, the federal government sold this as an irresistible deal. It would cover 100% of the cost for the newly eligible population, at least initially. Today, that rate sits at 90%. still far more generous than it pays for traditional enrollees like children and the disabled. To put this plainly, Washington is giving states more money to cover people who are able to work than it gives them to cover people who can't. That's not just bad policy, it's upside-down logic. More troubling is what this means in practice. Roughly 30% of Medicaid participants today are due to the Obamacare expansion. Through this major expansion, the federal government has created a powerful disincentive to work. When individuals can receive taxpayer-funded health care without being employed, many will choose not to participate in the workforce altogether. This is not conjecture. This is basic economics. Incentives matter, and bad incentives produce bad results. States, for their part, have largely taken the bait. All but 10 states have adopted the expansion, enticed by the promise of the so-called free federal dollars. But we know there's no such thing as a free lunch. It's taxpayer money, borrowed, printed, or taxed into existence. It is money we do not have, being used to support behavior we should not encourage. See the national debt clock for a fiscal wake-up call if needed. Today, it sits at about $36.8 trillion and counting. Worse still is the rampant fraud and abuse that characterizes programs of the size of Medicaid and complexity. Medicaid is jointly funded by the federal and state governments, but administered by the states, often with little oversight. That's a recipe for waste. A recent investigation by the Wall Street Journal found that Medicaid paid out more than $4.3 billion over just 3 years to individuals who were enrolled in multiple states. That's not a clerical error. That is systematic failure of basic administrative competence. Overall, according to the nonpartisan Paragon Institute, federal improper payments in Medicaid totaled $1.1 trillion over the past decade. And unbelievably, the Biden administration actually put rules in place to make it more difficult for states to determine proper eligibility of those enrolled in Medicaid. Thankfully, lawmakers in states today, like Indiana and Idaho, were successful this year in their efforts to require regular eligibility verifications matched against federal databases, work requirements, and other common sense reforms to their Medicaid systems. States continue to lead on the big ticket policy reforms America desperately needs. Medicaid reform at the state or federal level isn't about denying care to the vulnerable. It is about ensuring the truly needy are not pushed aside by policies that prioritize able-bodied, working-age adults without children. If Medicaid is to serve its original purpose, providing a safety net for those who cannot help themselves, it must return to that purpose. Congress now has a critical opportunity. That includes implementing common sense eligibility checks, data sharing between states, and stronger anti-fraud measures to ensure the program isn't being looted in plain sight. Public policy should not be judged by its intentions, but by its results. And the results of Medicaid expansion under Obamacare have been dependency, more fraud, and more fiscal recklessness. We are told that compassion requires even more government spending, but real compassion means ensuring that help is targeted, effective, and sustainable. A program that subsidizes inactivity while diverting resources from the truly vulnerable is not compassionate. It's irresponsible. For more information and ideas from policy reforms in the states and Medicaid reform, you can visit ALEC.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliates, WFIL-AM and WNTP-AM in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Welcome to our new listeners in the Keystone State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal. lighting the brush fires of freedom.